The theme is domestic service in contemporary perspectives. We will hear first Carol Wolkovich and then Eleni Kamburi. Shall I start? Would you like the microphone?
Yes, please. Tell me if I'm not loud enough, please. Right, I, like everybody else, have changed my talk a bit. I will actually get to Live Dirt, but I want to contextualize this idea first. For quite a while now, I've been thinking about the looking at bodies at work, is what I call it. Thinking about the embodiment of work relations, the embodiment of employment relations. It's quite obvious, of course, that work relations are embodied, but very often we take that for granted and we don't focus on it specifically. So my project is actually to make the embodiment of work a much more visible and indeed tangible aspect of what we understand by work. And as part of that, I've sort of developed a concept of what I call body work, which is work focusing on paid work in this case, focusing on the bodies of other people, clients, customers, employers, patients, and so on. So that would include work such as medicine, paid domestic work, sex work, tattooists, hairdressers, and so on. So in a way, it's making connections between some of the kinds of work that we were talking about earlier, and people were talking about domestic or quasi-domestic practices, but trying to connect them up in a different way, a slightly different way. So there's a kind of intuitive connection, I think, say, between sex work and domestic work, which I'm trying to conceptualize in terms of its common relationship to the body and the close intersubjective relation between the body of the worker and the body of, I'll say, consumer, just for short, okay? And although I call it body work, I don't mean to imply that this is a mechanical form of work as just body work. It frequently, indeed, usually involves emotion, sometimes affective relations, and so on. But obviously it varies in terms of what the meaning of different kinds of body work is in different contexts. And there are a lot of variables, of course, and constraints over the kinds of meanings which people can give to this kind of work. So what I'm trying to do then is to put this, as it were, into the pot to see what it might add to what we understand by paid domestic work in different situations. One of the other things about this idea of body work is that I think it enables certain kinds of comparisons between kinds of work, but it's also a kind of bridging concept between macro and micro level, in the sense of one can try and think about the macro variables which influence the interaction between bodies in day-to-day work. So I identified four aspects of what I call the social relations of body work. They're not meant to be, I mean, I'm sure there are others, but I'll just list them for reasons of time. One is concepts of the body that guide workers. So in professional employment, often these concepts are quite explicit, as in medicine, and they're part of a formal credentialized training. But in other forms of body work, the concepts of the body are implicit and are very often based on everyday ideas about what bodies require for their support and so on. And these implicit concepts of the body, and indeed the explicit ones, are also vary in terms of some of the other parameters. There's actually a very interesting study of manicurists in America called the Managed Hand. And she uses a concept, she's called Milan Kang, she uses a concept of body labor, which is very interesting because it's, as far as I can see, very similar to this. So it's sort of whether labor or work, I'm not sure how much, you know, the actual word makes, how much difference it makes. but she shows how the worker's understanding of the hand and what the hand involves is actually very different depending on class differences, ethnic differences, and so on between workers and the clientele in manicure salons. Okay. Second aspect of body work is that the division of labor is steeply hierarchical and deeply intertwined with gender, sex, and racialized assumptions, so that the segmentation of the labor market is deeply intertwined with notions about bodies, body parts, body fluids, and their potential. So the higher ranking parts of the body, like the head, and lower ranking parts of the body, and so on. And these are, as I say, intertwined with racialized and classed aspects. Bridget Anderson makes quite a lot of this in her book, Doing the Dirty Work. And like me, she was very much influenced by the history of writings on domestic service in Victorian Britain, and this idea that Victorian Britain was composed of a social body in which the middle class man was the head, the working class man was the hands, the middle class housewife was the heart, and the domestic servant was what they called the nether regions, i.e. the lower half of the body. And I think that puts it quite well, this close connection between the body and types of work. A third aspect of body work is that it's characterized by, you can think of it very spatially in terms of sites of labor. Its sites tend to be particular places, and particularly places that are conceptualized as private, especially the home, but not only the home. And it's also, as we've been discussing, transnational. So we have global care chains which are connecting the spaces in which body work takes place. And finally, a fourth element is the micropolitics of the intersubjective interaction as an embodied interaction. And the power relations of these micropolitics are obviously shaped in ways which we've already been discussing this morning, and I'm sure that you're aware of that and many other parameters. However, I would argue that working on bodies gives rise to relations of power and control and does not just reflect wider relations. So, to quote, I'm not giving chapter and verse, touch is a social relationship. So on the one hand, there may be a drift towards the territorialization and objectification of bodies by those who administered to them. That in part reflects, or stems from, I should say, the physical postures adopted by the worker in relation to the bodies in their care. So it will be different looking after a child who runs about as compared to someone who is paralyzed, say, or very elderly. I think Perennius talks about that. And very often the person cared for in bodywork or looked after in some way is horizontal, is often naked, is often ill or disabled. So that contributes, that very physicality of the embodied relation will contribute to the relationship between them. If you think about healthcare and you think about people who must inflict pain as part of their jobs, they have a more distanced relationship usually to the patient than, say, a complementary therapist who works mainly on the surface of the body. So that's that idea. There are some ways in which actually the worker in bodywork, bodywork occupations, but actually it's an element in many different kinds of work rather than an occupation as such. But there are elements of power that accrue to people who work on bodies. But at the same time, of course, there are many, many ways in which their power vis-a-vis those they are working with is reduced, and particularly the intimacy of the work and the privacy within which body work usually takes place may make workers extremely vulnerable to violence, and the polluting substances with which they work may give rise to or exacerbate disrespect. So I think what I'm trying to say here is that, I mean, it's really talking about work which is intimate, and I think that it's an issue that we shouldn't assume that many of the things that we talk about domestic work, relate to the household, because intimate work also goes on outside the household, whether it's hairdressing or all these spa treatments that are growing, as well as nursing. And many of the things that we're thinking about may actually reflect the intimacy as much as household relations as such. At least it's something to think about. So with that in mind, then, I started to think that, well, it's sort of obvious that many aspects of body work involve what sociologists call dirty work, which is defined as work which is thought to involve disgusting substances, or which is morally dubious, morally disgusting. And in the sociology of work, I'm sure you know that there's been a certain amount of attention to the kinds of rationalizations and strategies which workers use to maintain their self-esteem in the face of wider beliefs that what they do for a job involves a certain amount of dirty work. So I started then to read up on dirt in culture, as it were, for a publication which is coming out in the autumn, which actually is very relevant here. It's called Dirt and Geographies of Dirt and Contamination, which is quite a nice title. And so I started to read up on dirt, and it seemed to me that what I was reading was very much divided in a binary way, which I didn't find very helpful. So on the one hand, there was the Mary Douglas stuff, which I'm sure some of you are far more familiar with than I am, and you'll probably tell me I'm wrong about what she says. But at least my understanding is that Mary Douglas and others see dirtiness as largely symbolic, as dirt symbolizing aspects of social relations. So polluting dirt is associated with body fluids, blood, milk, urine, feces, sweat, and tears that are feared because they are linked to body orifices and connote potential threats to the social collectivity. And then there's this idea that margins and borders are problematic and messy and untidy for societies, so that reflections about purity and pollution are actually reflections about order and disorder, form and formlessness, being and non-being. And hence the well-known phrase, nothing is dirty in itself, dirt only exists as matter out of place. Now, non-anthropologists tend, I think nowadays, to read Douglas through the lens of more post-structuralist accounts, such as Julia Kristeva and Elizabeth Gross. And it can be argued that this literature sees dirty and clean as mainly linguistic categories and gendered speech, rather than real dirt or clean or dirty objects. So as in and post-structuralist thought, there's no really originary source for what exists in language or representation, so that binary oppositions like clean and dirty or pure or impure exist in language rather than the empirical world. In opposition to this kind of thinking about dirt symbolically is the rise in objectivist, naturalistic, or evolutionary accounts. According to these, dirt is found in nature rather than defined by human societies. Aversion to dirt has evolutionary benefits, and because it's objectively dangerous. And such arguments are now reinforced by evidence that the disgust response is rooted in brain chemistry. Well, I didn't find this binary very helpful, actually, if I'm right in identifying it, because I felt that, first of all, dirt and cleaning up dirt has more than symbolic value, and we can't stop at this symbolic level. We have to go beyond the discursive. On the other hand, I didn't find the evolutionary objectivist accounts very helpful either. So I thought, well, what we really need to do is to think of concepts of dirt and cleaning, which focus more on the lived experience of dirt and how that's underpinned by powers, strategies, and constraints available to different social groups, hence the idea of lived dirt. Because this way of thinking about dirt is embedded in the material relations of social reproduction, it goes beyond the merely discursive. I would see dirt as constructed in relation to and within social relations, and not simply as representing them symbolically. And I think in the position paper I was picking up really some of the same ideas in different words. Am I running out of time? Am I all right?
Maybe.
No, I think you're...
Okay, a little bit, okay.
Another 5-6 minutes?
Okay. So then I started to explore ideas about gendered dirt, which were embedded in ideas of people that do work which is considered dirty work. And I came across quite fascinating account of what I'll call manly dirt in a piece of journalism, award-winning journalism, for a New York newspaper, which I'll just tell you about because I found it so fascinating. It was interviews with male workers who work in what's called a MRF in Midwest America. That's a materials recovering facility where they deal with recycling products, and it's very, very dirty work. There's a huge number of health hazards and safety hazards attached to it, and it sounds awful. Anyway, he interviewed, the labor turnover is astronomical, but the workers who remain apparently shrug off the health risks, having made their peace with the stigma of, quotes, working in garbage. Interviewed while flies swarm on his face and hands as he sifts raw trash, one of the men remembers his first day at work at this MRF. "I threw up 3 times. Didn't stop working though. I just stepped back and vomited into the nearest can." Now I read this as another version of the heroic worker that heroic manly worker that we were hearing about. And not only that, he goes on to say there's stuff here that would even make Superman sick. So we know that it's a heroic manly form of work. He then goes on and conceptualizes his dirty work as dollars in the pocket, clearly rationalizing his work in terms of his role as a male family breadwinner. So another man goes on to say, "It used to bother me that I'd get home and my kids would say, 'Daddy, you stink.' Now I tell them, 'Yeah, but you never say that on Fridays when I come home with a pocket full of cash.' So this stink gets converted, as it were, to the money to support the family." So I think of this is manly dirt, which is sustainable in the role of heroic male family breadwinner. What about feminized dirt is much more closely associated with the dirtiness of the body. And there's interesting work by Lisa Whitting Isaacson, some of you may know, about formal and informal care of the elderly. She argues that the bodies of the elderly are seen as much dirtier than the bodies of children because they are open and unlimited. They represent an accumulation of living and eating and drinking over a lifetime, and also the nearness to death. Whereas children are less contaminating. And she says this is women's work par excellence, women dealing with, let's say, leaky bodies for a moment. However, it's a very polarized view between men and women and their relation to dirt. And I think obviously we need to think about how different women in different social locations are located in terms of dirt and what their relationships to that are. And I'm running out of time, but I want to mention the work of Cynthia Solari in the United States, who's looked at Russian-speaking immigrants to California who do care work paid by the government. And she, men and women, and she identifies 2 different discourses of care work which have a different relation to the dirty work which is involved. One which is care work as saintly work, which is able to accommodate dirty work because of the elements of sacrifice. And another identity, work identity, which is the professional status of the worker as working for the government, caring for people. And these workers are much less able to accommodate the dirtiness of the work. Interestingly, these workers are differently ethnically, and the saintly workers are Russian Orthodox, and the ones who see the work as professional are Jews, and they've all been trained in different institutions and recruited by different agencies so that these discourses are reproduced through many different modes. I just mentioned one final point, partly because it relates to an earlier paper. Barbara Ehrenreich's piece on cleaning and global woman says something which I think is very interesting. She talks a bit about the effects of paid cleaning on the identities and relationships in the household. And she mentions, of course, the stigmatizing of the body of cleaners, but she also mentions the effect of cleaning, paid cleaning, on the understanding of the bodies of the employers. So she says that to be cleaned up after is to achieve a certain magical weightlessness and immateriality, i.e. putting into place a particular construction of the employer's body as well as of one of the workers. And this also extends in a way to the children in the household, she says, because it's not simply that the workers might be caring for the children, but a generation ago the children would have done chores in the household, which they're no longer doing. So they now experience themselves as not having work obligations in the household too. So I think that I guess what I'm arguing is that we can see more about these relationships if we highlight both the embodiment and the bodily elements of pollution and dirtiness which are there.
Thank you. Very nice. We shifted to more bodily discourse. Elaine Kambura.
First of all, I would like to apologize because this is a paper I've been working on for a long time. I stopped because I gave birth to my baby, and now I'm trying to pick up the pieces again and make a paper. So if it doesn't sound very coherent, I'm sorry.
Not the baby's fault.
I know. The paper is entitled Feminine Job, Masculine Becomings, Gender and Identity in the Discourse of Albanian Domestic Workers in Greece. Despite of its...
And you haven't changed it.
No, and I haven't changed it. Because
the tradition.
Break the tradition.
So, despite its dynamic character, the literature on gender and migration has been dominated by the figure of the migrant woman as a victim. It could be argued, for example, that descriptions of domestic and sex workers as being servants of globalization or the most widely exploited and most vulnerable to abuse and violent workers cannot and do not represent the lives of many migrant women. And especially those women I interviewed during the research project. In the Greek context, it still remains to be seen to what extent we will be able to develop frameworks and perspectives that move beyond concepts like the multiple layers of oppression or hyper-exploitation, and rethink and conduct research on migrant women as political subjects. I think that this is a political objective that goes beyond the current research agendas. It touches upon the politics of migration per se. Because while it is impossible to ignore the gender aspects of migrant exploitation, the figure of the female victim of migration complements the figure of the threatening male victimizer that constitutes a threat for Western societies and adds towards a negative conception of international migration. Thus, I think it becomes politically urgent to address those issues without the umbrella of victimization that dominates our way of thinking, including my way of thinking in many cases. For this reason, I'm using some analytical categories that Judith Butler has introduced, mainly the concept of the standards of gender intelligibility, and the idea that identities are performed. And I understand gender as a free-floating artifice that materializes in discourse, which means that both men and the masculine can inhabit female bodies, and women and the feminine can inhabit male bodies. This article is based on a research project which is also part of the Pythagoras funding, and it consisted of 8 focus group discussions with Albanian women working in the domestic sector in Athens, 10 interviews, biographical interviews, and it is also based on my own experience as part of the Diction group, which is an anti-racist group working in Athens. Now, the paper begins by discussing a little bit the ways in which the Albanian women I talked to conceptualize domestic work in Albania. And then goes on to talk about domestic work in as a profession in Greece. I think that it is very important to understand and analyze the ways in which migrant women themselves remember and reinterpret and reconsider their past, because the relationship between past and present in migration is dynamic, and it's inscribed in both space and time. Since the past is attached to Albania, but an Albania that no longer exists, an Albanian woman can only revisit this place in their recollections and not in their actual travels back home. There are 3 points I would like to make with regards to this past. Firstly, most women recall that there was strict movement controls by the state, which meant that they couldn't move freely within Albania or outside Albania. Secondly, that women experienced a violent movement once they were married, because they had to move to a tradition and law imposed that they had to go move with the husband's family, and this meant that domestic work was for them a responsibility, since they, in a sense, that's how they some of them described it to me. They had to earn their living in the husband's house. And finally, this meant that Albania came to symbolically represent a closed and private space, while the outside world was the public space par excellence. The outside world was the masculine domain, while Albania came to represent in their memories what is closed, what is secure, but it's also what prevents them from realizing their potentials. I think in order to understand the ways in which they describe the space of domestic work today in Athens, we have to keep these things in mind. I think it is very interesting how some women describe their first impressions of Athens when they first arrived here. While there was obviously insecurity regarding the language, learning the streets, etc., Maria says, I was very impressed by women who drove cars, very, very impressed. In Albania, we didn't have anything similar. All the other women in the group agree. I was very impressed, too, with cars and the roads, that women were able to drive. And secondly, I liked supermarkets very much, the mirrors, the lighting, to the point that once I got confused looking at the mirror and thought, where are we here? This is the same public spaces that impress newcomers also cause an anxiety, fear and uncertainty. For example, one Albanian woman told me that she was vomiting each time she was entering the train or the bus. She actually felt nausea and she had to get out and get in again in order to get adjusted, to familiarize with public space. On the contrary, the recollection, so there is a kind of, there is an amalgam of being very impressed by public spaces, but also being, feeling insecure in those public spaces. On the contrary, the recollections of the first private homes describe as a deterioration in the standards of living. For example, there were no basement flats in Albania. So, and most Albanians told me, most women who came here told me that they had to live in basements, and this was really degrading for them. So, in that sense, migrant transitions transform the private domestic space from a closed confine into a place of social acceptance and upwards mobility. For many women, renting or owning a private domestic space signifies a departure from what the Albanian past represents for them. So, and in particular, the traditional attachment to the husband's family and the mother-in-law. This departure may account for the high significance attached by Albanian domestic workers to preserving the feminine character of their own private spaces. And this is how, at least I can explain, why they invest so much time and so much money and so much energy in caring for their own houses. While it is their profession, they also take pride of having the cleanest and the most sophisticated, they buy lots of decorating magazines in order to be in fashion. And they need to be constantly informed about decorating trends and etc. What is interesting to know is that domestic work becomes a space of intersection between class, rates, religion, ethnicity, education, and citizenship, where identities are constantly renegotiated. And these processes of negotiation are interpreted through the prism of the relations of power involving multiple strategies and tactics, and not simply the domination and exploitation of migrant women as victims. And here I'm using Judith Butler in her conception of power, and especially in what she says regarding a passionate attachment to subjection. She says power imposes, it is not important to take into account not only how power imposes itself on us and weakened by its force we come to internalize or accept its terms, but also we should begin to think how we who accept such terms are fundamentally dependent on those terms for our existence, and how we develop a passionate attachment to the object that subjugates us, the object of our subjection. This is not obviously sadism, that we enjoy what subject us, but it is a way of understanding Albanian domestic workers in political terms. That is, that the domestic work for them, at least the way I saw it and the way they described it, in my opinion, is that it is not simply for them a burden, but it is also a source of enjoyment and creativity. And now I will try to explain a little bit how this works. Okay, one of the predominant characteristics of the focus group discussion was that all women agreed that domestic work overtakes their everyday life, both the space of their everyday life and the time of their everyday life. What this means is that basically Esme, for example, works for 6:30 in the morning to 10 p.m. In the evening, and only rests for 30 minutes in between jobs. She uses public transport, which makes her workload even worse, and then goes home and does all the domestic work in her own house, which has to be perfect as well, her own house. So there's no time for anything else. I suffer a lot. Let's say that my life is empty. Rita, and who is she was around she was 50 years old. She woke up at 6 to 6:30. She had to clean houses, offices, and then in the evening she was washing up dishes in a restaurant in Athens. And while work offered economic and social benefits, for her, working in other people's houses and saving other people's times meant being able to enjoy her own private space. She was working so much because she wanted to earn money to have the perfect house, both in Greece and in Albania. She owned, actually, she was working from 6 in the morning to 12 in the evening, and she owned two houses, one in Greece, one in Albania. So we see that the extension of the logic of caring to paid domestic tasks silenced the inability to control one's own life in time and space. These conditions obviously are worsened by the predominance of informal agreements and precarious arrangements, but also in many cases it is the employees themselves that overload their work time deliberately with tasks, either because they want to finish faster and be able to move to another job and get more money, or because they themselves desire the work to be as close as possible to the consumer standards of cleanliness and order that conform also with the Albanian standards of femininity. So we could say that this is where they develop, in Butler's terms, a passionate attachment to the object of their subjugation. So their ability to take care of the house in a professional manner, which is often described as Albanian perfectionism, gives them pleasure and transforms common repetitive tasks into creative work. Marina says, you know what I want? I don't want simply to pull the sofa. I want to pull the sofa and put it in the middle of the room and clean underneath. Do you understand? Otherwise, I feel like I haven't been doing my job. But she doesn't want me to, the employer. She wants you to finish quickly, because if you don't do the job properly, time passes by and she has to pay. So the standards of gender intelligibility in domestic work are double conditions by notions of care and consumerism prevailing both in Albania and Greece. What prevails in domestic work, according to their narratives, is that they do not actually meet with their employers. The work is usually done in an empty house because people have to go to work. And communication between the domestic workers and their employers is done usually through traces that they leave or that the employers leave at home. So this is how communication usually takes place. Marina explains, when I'm gone and she comes in, I want something to be different. I want her eye to catch it, to notice that something good has been done, that something has been done and someone has made an effort. And she will think that it was Marina that fixed it. That's the reason why I always try to make something visible, to look different than what was there before, and cleaner. This woman will come in and she will think, what did she do? What has she changed? What has changed in my house? But it is up to each person to be able to see. So the ability of the employers to read the signs, to accept and comment on the traces left behind is very important, precisely because it establishes a feminine link. Traces can only be intelligible by the female eye, which diminishes the cultural and economic distance between the migrant and Greek women. Rita, for example, recalls with pride that once a male employer exclaimed, "This is not my house." And Esme says, "Wherever I go, they always ask me to arrange things the way I want them, to arrange things as I see with my very own eyes." The relationships through traces often end up into conflicts, which usually they are unspoken. For example, Linda and Lily receive calls in the evening from employers who have lost or misplaced their things, and they consider this to be an extension of their working hours, because obviously if you get a call at 12 o'clock, where did you put this, you have to start thinking what you did in the house in order to remember where it was. And they're really annoyed about things like that. And the other thing is that often employers position traces like traps in the house. So Esme recalls, for example, that one employer actually put a 50 euro note under a bed, and when she started hoovering, and when she was leaving the house, she said, "Where is this 50 euro note that I put under the bed?" And she, the domestic worker didn't know, of course, because she just hoovered the things. She didn't have a clue. It was under the bed. And she remembers, she told me, hopefully, I thought that it might have been swollen by the hoover, so I opened the hoover and I showed it to her. So, so we can see that typically feminine tasks are transformed into public questions of racism and anti-racism. Having the freedom to decide how domestic space is arranged and impose one's own standard of beauty and cleanliness becomes essential to the development of this relationship. Working with employers sometimes is very it's something that they want. Maria says, "I go to this house, we begin at 8 in the morning and finish at 8 in the evening. People ask me, how can you stand it? But it is not that I work for 12 hours. We arrange and clean the bedroom together. We work together, both of us. We put the seats and the carpets together. I don't like I don't like this way, Marina. Maybe we should change it. What do you think?" she says, the employer. "This way we will do the whole house, but it's like being at home. It is not that I've been working 12 hours." On the contrast, the ignorance exhibited by many Greek employers is treated ironically by Albanian domestic workers, who call their kyries, madams that is, ignorant. So Linda says, "Girls, I want to tell you a story. There is this little girl, whenever I go to her house, she's gone and she always leaves a piece of paper that big, and she shows an A4 paper. And she writes down all the tasks that need to be done. But she has no clue. I call her, I tell her that I cannot make these things even if I was working for a week. Not even half of what she's asking me to do. She says, 'Okay, Lindy, I don't have a clue about domestic stuff. She's nice, she's a lawyer. But the next time I go there, I find the same paper again.'" And Esme said, "Yes, yes, they ask me to do impossible jobs like washing and ironing the clothes the same day. And when will they dry?" although the tasks they perform are strictly within the stereotypical female enclave, which is also strictly limited to the private sphere, unskilled, low paid, undervalued, for Albanian domestic workers, these womanly tasks can offer avenues of empowerment and of enjoyment. Being a good housewife does not necessarily imply an identity attached to the Albanian pastoral tradition, but might also come to signify a more dynamic professional identity that distances women from the Albanian past and tradition and brings them closer to Greek professional women. These contradictions are inherent in the relationship between gender and migration. Even for women like Katie, who used to be a professional engineer in Albania, it is offensive to challenge her ability to care professionally and share or even exceed her employer's good taste. And this challenge that does not simply arise from the exarchical of the so-called female job in Albanian culture, but also by the in-between character of domestic space that is never simply private, nor simply public. As Renata argues about her male employers, okay, I'm not saying that there are no Greeks who work hard. I say he is strong, he works like an Albanian woman. Conclusion, sorry. So by asserting their creativity at the limit, Albanian domestic workers in Athens contribute to the production of the space and time of domesticity and care in which multiple complex migrant and gender identities can be performed alongside that of the victim that prevails in migration literature. As Renata says, I say that the Albanian woman, as history tells it, I say that she's a cleverer woman than women in Greece. She's cleverer, stronger, and more overloaded. In most analysis, women are represented as doubly disadvantaged in the mind-body relationship, firstly because as migrants they are associated with manual and skilled jobs, and secondly because as females they are limited to the confines of private and paid domestic activities. Albanian domestic workers gradually come to perform identities that redefine the space of domesticity by doing women's jobs in distinctively male ways. They transform daily the closed private space of domestic work into an open field where the possibility of alternative transgender and transcultural identities can be discerned.
Thank you.
Can I have some water?
We can follow the pattern already established for questions. I think a half an hour would be fine.
And what was the time now?
It's 2:27.
Half past two.
20 minutes. Okay. 20 minutes. Questions.
And points. I mean,
points. Statements. Observations. Sarah.
I really enjoyed and got a lot out of both of these papers. I particularly enjoy the idea of the geography of urban contamination. You must tell me when this book comes out. I must get a copy of it. One of the things that reminded me about that is that I think is very important in what you said in the two contrasts of the binaries of, and I think there's no right way to interpret Douglas anymore. She's been so used and abused that there is no. The important point there, I think, is that for me, you identified somebody else, Marilyn's referred, classified as the difference between the cultural and the social in looking at these questions. And your cultural seems to be very much, at the moment, there's lots of different definitions of it in terms of identification through containment and through bounding something and making it different from something else. And social always is about relations and extending across differences and also about structures and so on. And so it seems to me that what you were saying is that binary didn't help because the one thing was kind of sort of social evolutionism, and the other one was kind of entirely sort of tending, interestingly, Douglas is very much a social anthropologist, but nevertheless tending towards the containment idea, and he wanted to look at much more the structure. I think that's a really important point in these things that I'm enjoying. And I was thinking, in terms of where anthropologists have been looking at this whole question of bodily substances and dealing with it, I heard a paper a long time ago, and I don't know whether the other anthropologists know whether Raina Rapp gave a talk in AAA a few years ago about viscosity, the viscous substances, both to do with bodies and other things, and trying to get again at that relationship between the narrative way of discursive way of analysing it, but also the relational one, and by focusing on sticky bodily substances. It was a great paper. I don't know whether she went on and published.
There's a nice line in terms of the current discussion, which is brought up, in fact, by Mary Douglas, drawing on Jean-Paul Sartre about sticky substances. And then Bauman uses it to talk specifically about the category of migrant and the impossibility of integration or assimilation, because you would make a migrant as a citizen, like you, but they would always also stand for the other. So the whole point about Mary Douglas, which I think is not correct in social anthropological readings, is that this is the starting point for what you do to change things and relate them and move the boundaries. It's not the end point. She's not a culturalist. She says, well, what do you then do if there is not that? Do you then put it in place, or do you get rid of it altogether, or what do you do?
Yeah. And the other, very quickly, is I found your use of Butler and the rejection of the kind of jouissance idea of immediately, as soon as you said, well, you know, I'm using Butler, and this is not about enjoyment of your subjection, I immediately thought of Zizek, you know, enjoying the symptom, and using a different bit of Lacan from the one that Butler uses on that. And what I found interesting about that, and I was just thinking on the hoop, and maybe you could tell me a bit more about it, because I hadn't really thought about this before, is whether what you were talking about suggests that you see, Butler, one of the things about Butler is she seems to imply quite a thin agent, that the subject is very thin, and there's very little to actual the idea of agency, and you seem to be implying something quite different from that in what you were saying in your work. And ironically, I think Zizek, even though he uses this kind of jouissance idea and enjoys sometimes terribly cynical in his analysis of how he uses that, has a much thicker subject in a sense, more agentful, despite the fact that there's... So I was kind of very interested in the example that you used, and I absolutely love the idea of traces. And leaving traces, and immediately, probably most of us could remember that we've done this, and the huge effort that goes into this kind of dance of being absent when the domestic worker is present, and different ways in which that's managed or arranged. There's a load of questions there, but what I became interested in, which relates a little bit to something I was thinking about this morning in relation to that, is the national issue, at least in the Greek context, because the one thing I was mentioning this morning, and listening to papers this morning, is that this island, so far as I know, does not have Turkish domestic workers. Does it?
No.
It has loads of Albanian ones, but no, and they're right across the way. And you know, it's very interesting to me that they're not here. And so in relation to that, I was kind of wondering whether, in your view, this relationship of traces, where there's a distance that's established in a very carefully managed kind of, do I trust you, do I not, do you know that I've done work, do you not, kind of way, whether that's even possible because of a kind of absence of powerful sort of state sorts of nationalist rhetorics about the relations between the two in the first place. I don't know. But I was just very interested in where the national issue might combined with the gender issue. Thank you.
Hello, Siliki.
Is somebody this next?
Yeah. We can have responses as well. I mean, you don't have to wait
for somebody. If somebody wants to speak here, Richard. Was it
Dean? Yes, I want to add something on the last comment. That, I wanted to disagree about this. It's a matter of interpretation, of course, but that Butler's notion of performativity and gender invisibility implies a thin subject or rejects agency. I think that, taking from Foucault this notion of power, that the subject they reproduce are part of their making as a in the making of their subordination, and they perform their subordination. So in your paper, I wanted to ask whether you didn't point it out clearly whether they reproduce their subordination through using these ideas of being taking pride of doing domestic work, and if or they move to some forward. By what you say, masculine becomings. So whether this resistance comes from within, so using the same terms of that make them subordinate, but they resist at the same time. But what exactly is this are these masculine becoming? Is there break this the subordination by using the
very
terms or not?
Okay. First of all, yes, I don't agree either that Butler's idea of agency is thin. Sorry. I think that the whole point about Butler reworking Foucault's notion of the subject is precisely that she gives. She's trying to somehow fill the gap of what's happening from the psychological aspect of the of things, and this is precisely in this book, the Psychic Life of Power, where she's trying to explain exactly how subjects are formed. From the perspective of the psyche, let's say. So I don't think that Butler's idea of agency is thin. I think that certain interpretations of Foucault can use a thin. But I think that also that in Foucault it's not that thin as people assume. Now, in order to explain this with regards to the paper, I think that what's happening with Albanian domestic workers is that precisely they reproduce, and at the same time they come to a point where they challenge the limits between masculinity and femininity. And that is where I think the possibilities of resistance lie. The possibilities of resistance do not lie in saying domestic work is enslavement for us, we have to throw our chains. The possibilities of resistance lie precisely in looking at domestic work as a space where these limits are put into questions, in my opinion, into question. And so when at the moment when domestic when Albanian domestic workers actually tease their use strategies to tease their employers, it might be much more important than actually, you know, shouting at their employers or saying, you know, teasing them, having, you know, putting traces in the house to, in order to complicate their lives, or, you know, things like that might be tactics of resistance in which we should focus. I think that one of the problem of the research that we conducted was that we didn't have this in mind already. We were actually looking for dominations, and we were not looking for strategies of resistance that actually challenge the limits. And I think this is something that has to be in future research on domestic work. This is something that has to be done to actually look at how domestic work becomes this independent space, where it is at once for migrant women is a professional space, a space of upwards mobility, but also a space of domination, a dangerous place because they might be different kinds of violence can be inflicted on them. It is a contradictory and ambivalent space, let's say. And this is how I think future research should start from this, actually. Not from, we shouldn't start from the idea that the subject of that we're actually trying to work with or the objects of our research are actually victims. I don't know if it makes sense. With regards to Zizek, okay, I don't know. I have a problem with Zizek and gender, basically, because his relationship is very problematic. I would love to use Zizek, but Zizek and gender is a very weird combination. So I don't know. I mean, I think he's lovely. He's wonderful. A wonderful thinker. But in terms of gender, he's not very good.
Akis may take maybe next time. Politician, or should you? Is this?
Let's not have a debate about either Butler or Zizek, I suppose.
Yeah.
No, but just my question was, what I cannot understand is, do they challenge the boundaries because they tease their employers?
No, because they challenge the boundaries because they they identify themselves as being both masculine and feminine, in the sense that what they do is a masculine job, but it is a job with feminine qualities. So they do not actually, this is how they construct their own identity, at the same time as being both masculine and feminine. That's what I find interesting. And there are other phrases, I mean, in terms of discourse, this game of I'm a man, I work like a man, I do women stuff, but I like a man, I am like a man, I have become a man, all that is very is widespread in their discourse. So I think that's where the possibility of resistance lies, not that I can identify the resistances in teasing or whatever, but I think that there is a possibility there.
Were you able to follow these women back to their own homes? To accompany them and spend time at their own homes?
The thing is not, because I have, through Diktion, I have become friends with some of these women. And not that I interviewed the same women that I have become friends with. But, and so I'm going to their houses, but it is not that I have gone to the houses of the people that I interviewed.
Because that would have been interesting to see how they organize their own households.
Yes, yes. It's,
and what
I think I made this clear, but basically it's all, what I'm trying to talk about is how they describe their own houses.
Mm-hmm.
They describe their own houses in this way as being ultra modern, ultra clean, ultra,
Papataxiakis. He'll take half an hour.
Oh, come on.
you have 5 minutes.
You can restrict me, whatever way you want. First of all, to say that the Albanian migration to Greece and Albanian migrant domestic workers apparently should become, as we move on, occupy the center, because there is a lot of research being done, and both the work done in Thessalia, in Pantheon, here, somehow are in conversation around this topic. What I find very welcoming from both Rix's presentation and Elaine's presentation is the fact that there's a reference to historical context. I mean, a tendency to historically contextualize the aspects of domestic workers' behavior in Greece at the moment. And in fact, I have to say that in a way, I thought that this contextualization could be more exploited analytically. I felt that in the course of your paper, this interest to place your ethnographic observations in the context of a wider theoretical discussion in relation with either Butler or somebody else, don't take advantage of the very interesting points that initially you made concerning images of the past and how these images of the past inform the strategies of the present. Having said that, I'm quite surprised by the differences between what different kinds of researchers find in discussing the same topic. And I'm waiting other colleagues here who are doing research on the same subject to speak up, because I think that at some stage we should start somehow, at least, we don't have to reach a consensus, but at least some basic things to make sure that we are speaking about the same phenomenon. Okay. Space seems to be very central in your in this conceptualization of the past. From the work of Angelikis, for example, who I have the honor to know some details since we are working together, I get the sense that work is also something quite important, and the work of Vasos Vagiorgiou in Patras as well brings that very strongly. And it doesn't surprise me at all, because we are speaking about a kind of socialist regime, in which work is, first of all, from the point of view of formal discourse, very central. Also, it is being invested with very specific meanings, which are being negotiated in the Greek context. So, and of course, work is also, a kind of historical consciousness of work. I would suppose that it would be very important in thinking about the behavior of these women in the present-day context. So, I would like a reaction, your reaction to that. I mean, I was surprised not to hear anything about work and to hear many things about space. That's one very simple question. And the second thing, which perhaps links to that, is that somehow I have the feeling that this theoretical agenda to go beyond this discussion about exploitation or super-exploitation and to try to give more emphasis on this workers' agency, I have the feeling that it, I welcome that, and I said that at the very beginning, but I feel sometimes that, we have, a great urge to find resistance everywhere, which I regard it a little bit frustrating, on the point of view of description of what's actually happening. Just to make a simple point here, what comes out from research on Albanian migrant domestic workers is, and what comes out from our research very clearly, is a very strong tendency towards professionalization, which is a means of upwards mobility. It's a very positive program. I mean, it seems that these women are not so eager to enter into any kind of dialogue with their employers. What they are very eager is to demarcate the sphere of activity and try within this sphere of activity to achieve this ideal of autonomy, which you very rightly stress and also Ricky stresses, and which may have a kind of masculine, let's say, references. and try to capitalize on something which they feel, I mean, that they have in plenty, which is their body. I mean, they believe in their bodily capacities and in their abilities to sustain, you know, bodily effort, and transform it into money, which money is the means to achieve a kind of consumption, you know, ideas about consumption, and move upwards. And so that's very, very briefly the sense I have of what's really at stake with migrant, Albanian migrant women in working in domestic service at the moment. Apparently, this doesn't look to fit very much with the picture that you draw, which means that, of course, always we can say that you know, there are particular cases. Perhaps you studied more one particular neighborhood, and we studied another neighborhood, or perhaps a different moment of time. I mean, conjuncture is perhaps crucial in these discussions. But I would suppose that probably, I mean, our theoretical agendas may also be important in this, in what we find out in the end. So I would like your response on that. Mm. And I'm keeping a point in relation with this, I mean, converting dirt into money, which I think links very much, I think, with Sophie's work as well, and with our work, which I find a very, very promising idea. I mean, I think we can work on it more in the course of the workshop.
Brief intervention here, just very, very big, just very quick. About that, that's what I meant about the Lisbon subject. I didn't mean that there was no agency. It's where the agency is located that's the question, which relates very much to the point that Agnes was saying.
Can I follow that? I was thinking when I was listening to you that actually that whole relationship, particularly of people who are coming from the socialist countries, but there's been this enormous valorization of labour and work. I think that relationship in domestic labour is it's very full of ambiguity and ambivalence. And part of saying, you know, these are our homes and they're clean and they're spotless, it's in a way they're saying, yes, there's a sort of reversal of hierarchy almost, of saying, yes, we're going to work for you, but we're actually doing things that you don't do properly because you don't know how to work properly, and we make it properly clean, and we make it, you know, you're a bit slovenly, all of you people. And, you know, I think that's it. And in a way, I was like Sarah, I was just enchanted by the traces. But I was thinking that you could, that in the context of that, in a way, you could say that part of what they can be seen as is a real authorship of saying, you know, this is a transformation. I'm claiming authorship of this space and the proper way to do this, but also a way of establishing a kind of relationality that's non-hierarchical too, that's sort of claiming a kind of authority. So when somebody says, yeah, we worked together for 8 hours and it didn't seem like work, in a way that's maybe the same kind of thing, I think.
Mm.
Yes.
Okay. I don't see why there is such a difference in what, at least in what Ricky said and what I said, in terms of how Albanian women domestic workers say things. I think there is a difference in the interpretation, mostly. I don't see that there is a great difference. In what I have viewed them, basically, you didn't use many abstracts from what they said, but I mean, I don't see that there's a question of me doing research with different subjects or anything like that. I think that there is a difference in interpretation, which has to do with the theoretical framework, in my opinion. And the difference is that. It's not that I'm trying to find agency in Albanian women, which is something that I think you do. Mostly. I mean, this is what you do. You're trying to find agency in Albanian women. I think the difference is that I'm trying to see how how these women interpret their own subjugation, let's say, to a system which is called domestic work. So we act sometimes as researchers as if the people we are talking to, they don't really know what the system is, and we should tell them what domestic work is. We should explain first what the space of domestic work is, and then they can come and tell us how they live this space. What I'm trying to do is rather the opposite. Is this space is constructed by those women. If they describe this space as being, let's say, ultra-modern, if they say that Greek households are not clean enough, you know, this space is constructed by them. It's not that the space exists out there, the system of domestic work exists, it's out there, and they would come and explain to us how they live the space that is already out there. The point is how they produce the space. This is the because this is the point of everyday life and the discourse of everyday life. Okay, this is the first point. The second point about the Albanian past. What you said about work is part of the paper. I just didn't mention it because I think it was covered by other. It's definitely. I mean. The Albanian woman cannot think of the housewife. The housewife does not exist in the universe of the Albanian woman. The housewife who stays at home and takes care of the kids. It doesn't exist, basically. What I try to emphasize is that domestic work in Albania. Okay, there was Albanian women were almost never housewives. But what I try to emphasize is that domestic work in Albania, as they remember it, was something exclusively reserved for females, and it was something exclusively locked into the private sphere. That's what I tried to say. Work is something that's obviously very important, but. And what is interesting is that the standards of gender and eligibility regarding the past, which is what femininity was in Albania, were determined by whether or not a woman was a good housewife. Although she was, all of them were working, they were actually telling you that. I have a quote here, I don't know if I will find it anyway. It says something like, if you want to be a real woman, you have to be able to mend your socks. You have to be able, because of the lack of consumer products, obviously, these were absolute. You have to be able to clean the house after you come back from work. You have to have the house spotlessly clean. And so you have a situation where actually domestic work is being, has to do only with the private space and becomes the essence of femininity. And this is what I find interesting, but I didn't mention it because I had to cut down the presentation. What else? In terms of resistances everywhere. I mean, this is a. I mean, this is something I think we should all look for. I think we should all look for resistances everywhere. And, this is like an ideological position, a moral stance. I think this is what we should be doing. And yeah, that's it. I don't know what
else. Fair enough. Yeah, straightforward position. Okay. Keep it in mind and we think about it till the afternoon.
It is three.
History, yeah.
We have to come back at 5:30, right?
Yeah.
That stands.
So, okay, and we can, resume and to go back to things that have been brought in previous phases. So, let me tell you what is the situation at the moment.